we're talking about a call for regulation as it relates to Husky Energy rebuilding its refinery in Superior. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A resolution was adopted by city leaders over in Duluth this week. They want the EPA to reconsider whether oil refineries can be allowed to use the dangerous chemical hydrogen fluoride in their processes. And this comes as Husky rebuilds its plant following the explosion that rocked the Twin Ports in April last year. Duluth Mayor Emily Larson was on our program at the one-year anniversary of the Husky fire.
I will be very pointed in saying that the response of the Husky team and the refinery was very disappointing. I am frustrated.
Do you live in Superior? Did you evacuate during the explosion and fire? What are your thoughts on Husky using hydrogen fluoride? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Payne is mayor of Superior. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
So here we are. It's been more than a year since the Husky refinery explosion. Duluth Mayor Emily Larson introduced this resolution to review hydrogen fluoride use at refineries, and it was adopted by the city council this week. Do you support this resolution? Do you think it's necessary?
Yes, I support the resolution. I think government agencies that oversee all of our industrial processes, but especially in this case, hydrogen fluoride, should be taking a look at this chemical. I think it's an outdated process, and we should be modernizing the refinery. And we need help from government agencies, particularly scientists, to help us do that.
So what does this resolution mean? What does it do?
Effectively, it really doesn't do anything at all. It is a statement by the Duluth City Council asking the EPA to review this. I don't think it has any real regulatory or legislative effect.
So if the EPA would look into this and find something wrong with the use of hydrogen fluoride, what could that mean for the future of refining and for the Husky refinery itself?
I think it just means a more modern refining process. It's worth noting that hydrogen fluoride is not the only way to refine petroleum. There are many more modern alkalization processes. And so what it would mean is refineries would begin updating to those more modern and hopefully safer processes.
Was hydrogen fluoride a factor in the explosion at Husky last year?
There was not a breach in the tank. It, of course, was something that we monitored all day. When I got into incident command that day, that was the very first thing that Battalion Chief Scott Gordon briefed me on, the amount of hydrogen fluoride in the tank, the integrity of the tank. And at the end of the night, as we were really wrapping things up and trying to call the disaster over, that was the very last thing that we checked. We weren't ready to lift the evacuation until there'd been an eyes-on inspection of the structural integrity of that tank. So it really was a central part of the risk in the emergency.
We're talking about a resolution that just passed in Duluth this week to review the use of hydrogen fluoride at refineries. Comes a year after the Husky refinery explosion in Superior, and the mayor of Superior, Jim Payne, is with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you think the EPA should intervene here and review hydrogen fluoride use? Join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. In April, Jim, WPR reporter Danielle Kading spoke with the chief operating officer for Husky about the necessity of hydrogen fluoride at its facility.
And reformulated gasoline, the alkylate, is fundamental. So if we took the unit out, we couldn't make gasoline, and that would essentially make this refinery non-viable for us.
That would essentially make this refinery non-viable for us. Do you think this chemical is that important in the refining process? What is the sticking point there?
Well, the refining process as it exists at the refinery right now. So I've spoken with all of the Husky officials, and the biggest reason for keeping hydrogen fluoride is because to replace it is to replace the entire alkalization process. You can't just remove this one element. It's not plug and play. And so that would be a very, very significant tear down and rebuild of the refinery. And partially because the emergency operations team did such a good job protecting that tank and that unit on the day of the fire, it's not significantly damaged. It's more or less fully operable. And so it would be replacing something that for them is working right now, and that would be a very expensive operation.
You said the Duluth resolution doesn't have much of effect. What actions could the city of Superior take to ensure safety in addition to the resolution to build upon it?
So we don't have very much regulatory power over the refinery. There are some permitting processes that we go through, same with any large business within our community. But of course, we want to make sure that this refinery achieves full operation as quickly as possible, too. We just want it to be done in the safest way possible. Now, if I felt that it was not safe in the community, that we could not or the refinery could not adequately protect their workers and the neighborhood around the refinery, we would be holding up that process every bit as much as we could, and I would be intervening in the public hearing process for the state and federal permits. But as much as I would like them to modernize this refinery and move along from hydrogen fluoride, I'm not seeing a significant actual risk to the community right now.
And last night, the Superior City Council passed a resolution to rebuild the Husky refinery safely. There's a lot riding on that word safely. What does that mean?
It means a lot of things, actually, more than just hydrogen fluoride. And that's why we opted for a more general term. What I have always said since the beginning, hydrogen fluoride is not my biggest concern in this refinery. We have to look at the actual facts here. That is not a disaster that has ever occurred in the United States, a release of hydrogen fluoride. I'm not sure it's ever occurred in the world. But explosions at refineries, particularly during a shutdown process, are very common, and they are very preventable. And without an explosion like that, no hydrogen fluoride release could ever occur, nor could the type of disasters like what we saw in Superior last year occur. And so my efforts have really been to try and get the refinery to mitigate those explosions, to prevent that from happening again, and to take other steps to protect the surrounding environment, to make sure that not only is it safe, but it's healthy for the environment that it exists in. And so there are a lot of comprehensive changes we're asking them to make, and they've made most of them.
What is the timeline looking like on the Husky rebuild as you know it?
It's a big project. They are hoping to be fully online by 2021. That could be delayed. This is a long process, so they're prepared for that to take as long as 2022.
And do you feel like in this rebuilding process, there's ample communication back and forth between this company and the city of Superior?
I think so, yes. They meet with me pretty regularly. They are open to meeting with really any elected official, I think, about any member of the community. They've invited some of their most outspoken critics to have direct meetings with them. They've held community meetings. I've encouraged them to continue to do that, especially as they run up to their permitting process and begin that process to come fully back online. So they've been very open with the community and willing to answer pretty much any question.
Mayor Payne, as we wrap up here, what about community members? Do you see at all that they have, some been very vocal, have they come around at all to using hydrogen fluoride and other concerns about this refinery in their backyard?
I think many people had a lot of knee-jerk reactions. They were very concerned about some of the worst-case scenario reports and some things that were misrepresented, and have been put a little bit at ease about the actual dangers of the hydrogen fluoride tank. It is not a risk to kill the entire Twin Ports. That is a lie when people say that. It is a significant risk in a worst-case scenario, but worst-case scenarios are very, very unlikely, and in some cases nearly impossible. So many people have come around, yes. And many people, I would say the vast majority of this community, supports this refinery and wants it to be open and operable.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mayor Jim Payne of Superior there. Up next, Wisconsin foreclosure rates are at a two-decade low. We'll look at that economic indicator. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at foreclosures here in Wisconsin across decades. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our state's rate of foreclosures is at the lowest point in two decades. So what does this mean for our local economy? What does it mean when statewide rates are low, but some specific communities have a high number of homes being repossessed? Have you gone through foreclosure? What is that experience like? We're at 800-642-1234. Russ Cation is an economics professor at UW-Whitewater. He is the director of the Fiscal and Economic Research Center at the university, and he joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Russ, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So rates for foreclosures at a two-decade low, what's going on? How did we get here?
Well, there's a couple of factors. One is the economy is doing very well. The unemployment rate's down. Income is high. Home prices are rising, and that would lead to an opportunity in case you had some financial challenges, often caused by health concerns or being laid off. You can sell into that market.
But, you know, since the Great Recession, we saw lending tighten up. It got harder to secure that mortgage. But in recent years, do you see lending loosening up at all?
I think it has. I think that we have tried to find opportunities to bring people back into home ownership. We saw the home ownership rate rise to an all-time high in just prior to the recession and then plummet. It's basically tacked up a little bit, but not a lot. And part of that is there's a lot of capital out there looking for a place to be invested, and so the banks are becoming a little more aggressive.
So what should we be taking from this data on low foreclosure rates? What does it really tell us?
Well, I think it tells us right, that foreclosure rates are low. We start there. That's good news. That's wonderful news. But for me, the reason I track it in spite of the fact that it's low is because we need to anticipate the next problem. About every 20 years in the United States, we see some kind of financial turmoil. And rather than wait till the turmoil hits us, we have to track numbers so that we can look for indicators of the coming problem. Had we been more vigilant in tracking foreclosures in 2005, 2006, we may have been in a better position to mitigate the problems that existed.
So some 2020 hindsight there. Is there an impact on the industry when data on low foreclosure rates are circulated? What are typical responses from buyers and sellers in this situation?
Well, I think it's happy. I think people, but I go back to the idea that there are people who have been left behind. There are neighborhoods that have been left behind. When we look at what we would describe as heat maps, we see that the foreclosure rates are highly concentrated in less wealthy neighborhoods, and so we get a little, we're happy. We're thrilled that foreclosure rates in Ozaukee County are very low, but relative to Ozaukee County, parts of Milwaukee County, Iron County, Sawyer County, continue to see relatively high rates.
We're looking at foreclosure rates in Wisconsin with Russ Cation. He is an economics professor at UW-Whitewater. Russ, let's look at those hot spots for a moment. There are two areas of the state where foreclosures are high. Milwaukee and Waukesha counties, as well as St. Croix and Pierce counties, have higher rates of foreclosure. Can you break down what is happening in those areas?
Well, in Milwaukee, it's income-driven. It is an inability to make the payments. The indicators of on a macro level, let's bore ourselves and talk about macroeconomics, our unemployment rate, wages, and items like that, non-performing loans. We continue to have, in portions of Milwaukee County, extremely high unemployment rates. As a result, any financial bump, any financial pothole that you hit, puts your livelihood, your assets at risk.
Well, outside of Milwaukee County, what's happening in those other areas where you see those red hotspots?
The red hotspots are, I would focus on Iron County. It's a county that has, for the last 25 years, seen a very challenged economy. income growth has been very low. And as a result, you know, once again, and we face this. What happens is our financial reserves as individuals is very low. And when anything goes wrong, we're incapable of pulling in assets. If you're in a wealthy county, you may have a 401k, you may have savings, you may have other assets you could sell and cover that shortfall for a short period of time. We don't see that everywhere throughout Wisconsin.
You made note of a hotspot that is around Hudson, Wisconsin, which is commuting distance to the Twin Cities. A number of people do that commute. Is there anything we can infer there around that in that area?
We had a huge problem up there. It's gone down, but we had a huge problem because it was a community that was very tied to the Minnesota financial market. So the U.S. Bank Corps headquarters type of institutions where there were great jobs, high-paying jobs. People spilled over into Wisconsin, built up a community. But then when we faced the financial crisis, it hit it hard because those institutions, like we saw with M&I or Anchor in Madison, we had a lot of institutions that failed or that saw dramatic reductions in their labor force. And that's one of the things that happened up there. It's come back, but I think it's something to keep an eye on. And it's areas that are tied to specific industries. If that industry is stressed, then we may have a problem with the housing market.
You've been studying foreclosure data in Wisconsin for about 15 years. What trends have you seen? Why do you stick with this data?
Stick with the data. Like I said, we always look at the present, and the present looks great. It's 7 in the morning. The sun's out. It's warm. I'm watching the birds. But we need to anticipate the storm that's coming upon us. And there will be a storm. I don't know what the storm will be. And so I'm watching foreclosures. Other people are watching student loans. Other people are watching car loans. But if we keep our eye on those balls, we can somewhat anticipate where these problems may occur.
So the housing bubble was a big factor in the Great Recession. And when we have a crisis like that, the reaction is a big solution, a big correction, perhaps even an overcorrection. Are there things we can do in times of stability or prosperity, incremental things that would prepare us for the next crisis that would minimize it?
Well, financial education is important. Letting people understand that hiding is not a solution. When we face these problems, there are institutions that can help you, whether it be community-based or whether it be the government or whether it be the bank itself, that we need to face the reality, go in, and ask for help when help is available.
So as you project out and look at foreclosures in the future, do you see stability or are there some things of concern in your crystal ball?
I see stability for the near term. I don't know what the near term is. So don't ask me that question. But I see stability for the near term. But I can tell you it's so low, you know, on a statewide basis. Every quarter, I'm fascinated how much lower it gets. And part of it is that there was a whole slice of society that has been pulled out of the home ownership, the ownership economy, you know, this dream. And so those people, many of those people never came back.
Will they ever come back?
I don't think so. I think that the problem I have is that these are momentous occasions in the history of a family that will reverberate throughout the entire 21st century. There will be grandchildren of people who were forcibly removed from their homes in 2010 who will know the story, and it'll change their perception of economics. And that's a concern of mine, that You know, 30 years from now, the 10-year-olds will be 40. And they will tell their children about that horrible occasion.
Russ, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Russ Cation is an economics professor at UW-Whitewater, and he heads up the Fiscal and Economic Research Center, and he studies foreclosures in Wisconsin. He joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. Coming up, more Americans are working past traditional retirement age. We get into what this means for the workplace and our economy. Are you over 65 and working full-time because you love it, or for financial reasons, or something else? Did you always plan to work at an older age? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's hear from you right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about working past traditional retirement age on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About one in five Americans who is 65 or older is still setting the alarm and heading into work each day. And that is the highest percentage in more than half a century. As more and more Americans delay retirement, that has implications on the people who fill their jobs once they do retire. And it says quite a bit about financial security. According to a recent Associated Press survey, almost a quarter of Americans say they plan to never retire. And it isn't because they just love their job so much. The U.S. faces a retirement crisis. Do you consider yourself an older worker? What's your job? How long have you been in that position? Do you plan to retire soon? Or ever. Join in the conversation at any point here, 800-642-1234. Abdur Chaudhry is an emeritus professor of economics at Marquette University. Abdur, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me back in your program.
Why are older workers delaying retirement? What are the big obstacles you're seeing?
There are a couple of reasons why older workers are working longer years compared to, let's say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. First, obviously, life expectancy has gone up, so people are working longer. Second, the baby boomers are more educated than, let's say, the previous generation. So as a result, they're also working more. And third, and I think the most important reason is because of changes in Social Security benefits and other welfare benefits, people do need to work longer in order to make ends meet.
So we're generalizing here, but, and you didn't list this off, but do baby boomers want to keep working, or do older workers need that steady income?
Both. In cases of some people, obviously, they need that extra income because of changes in Social Security benefits, because they're living longer. And second, some baby boomers do want to work for longer years.
More than 25 million Americans who are 60 and older are considered economically insecure, and that data comes from the National Council on Aging. How much of this delaying retirement is due to income inequality? How does that factor in?
That is also another factor. What we have seen in the U.S. Over the last 20 years is that income inequality has increased, while we have seen a huge increase in income in the top, say, 1% to 10% of the population. The lower quantile of the population has seen their income go down, and there is also some racial element in it. So as a result of that income inequality, we do see some people have to work longer years.
We've seen, of course, the decline of pension plans and even pensions that are facing economic problems that they can't pay out. Do you think this is contributing to what people are calling a retirement crisis?
Sure, it is. Many corporations have cut down on their pension plans in many different ways, and that is affecting many older retired workers. Some of them have to go back to work. Some of them have to take a part-time job. Especially in case of health insurance, we have seen a cutback in many corporations, pension plan. So that has really affected the older generation.
When you talk about the changes to Social Security benefits, what are you seeing there?
We do see some changes where, the cost of living has gone up. The Social Security, although it's indexed to inflation, the Social Security benefits, it's not keeping up with the increased cost, especially medication cost, for example. That's one of the things that comes out. Medication cost has increased significantly. So that has forced many retirees to, let's say, go back to work, or many older workers to delay their retirement.
We're looking at why many Americans are working well past traditional retirement age with Abdur Chaudhry. He is an emeritus professor of economics at Marquette. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a business or organization that currently employs older workers? Or are you older than 65 and working full-time? Do you find challenges working at your age? Do you find yourself working because you want to, or are you saving for retirement? Do you wish you could have saved more in the previous years? Join in with your story, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Abdur, how are baby boomers driving our U.S. job growth? What are you seeing there?
Baby boomers have been the mainstay of the U.S. labor force. Baby boomers, basically, who have been born between 1946 and 1964, they are now in their 60s and 70s. So, as I said, the older generation of the baby boomers, they are staying longer in the labor force. So they are, to some extent, influencing the labor force growth.
Let's bring in Jeff now from Appleton. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. What is your situation?
Well, I'm nearing 50, and I got about 10, 12 years left in me. But the reason I'm in that situation is because I've saved. Retirement is, it's not a short term. It's not a big lump sum going in somewhere. It's small amounts going in every week. And I hear a lot of on the show so far, it's this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason. And the biggest reason is because people simply haven't put off the wants of today for what they know they're going to need when they get older. It's a long-term game, a long-term game. And if you're not putting the money away, you're not going to have it.
So, Jeff, you exercised that fiscal responsibility very early on. Were you adding to a retirement savings from a company like 401k, or where were you putting away dollars for retirement?
I put away both into my 401k, and I also saved extra money on top of that. It's something it's a known thing. You know you want to retire, and it's if you don't prepare for it, you're not going to be able to do it.
Do you find that you have any concern about the markets, that your money is tied into the markets and they can go up and down? There could be a crash. How do you buffer yourself from that?
Well, just about every 401k plan they have, you can either do self-directed or they have plans where you can put it into a high risk, mid, low risk. In my situation, I'm getting to the point where I'm going to be starting to transfer into a low risk, mm-hmm. where I won't be risking the big swings of the market.
So you really target for your age group. Yeah. Well, yeah, Jeff, thank you so much for explaining your situation on target for retiring right around age 62. Abdur, it sounds like he really had that financial restraint early on in order to be able to retire around 62.
Yes, he is in a good situation right now. But what we have seen nationally, as you know, in the U.S., we don't save as much as we should. It's a consumption-oriented society. We don't save as much as, say, countries like Japan or Western Europe. We have one of the lowest savings rate, which hovers around 5%. So since we don't save much, so as he pointed out correctly, that you know, during time of retirement, we don't have a big nest to take care of ourselves.
Well, let's place economics aside for a moment. There are some people who pursue their passion in the second half of their life. They go after what are known as encore careers. Do we have any sense of who is working to keep doing something they love rather than trying to afford to live?
Yes, we do. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps some numbers on that, and we do see a significant proportion of the labor force basically continue to work because they like their job, they like what they do, and that's one of the motivation for them to continue to work. So that's a significant portion of the labor force.
What are the benefits of having older workers in the office, in the workforce?
There are some benefits. There are also some costs involved. Benefit, I would say, is the experience. Because they have been in that job or in other jobs for a long period of time, they have that experience which can help the incoming new workers. So the experience, I would say, is the big plus.
Do you... go ahead.
On the negative side, obviously, companies where they're working, they do see an increase in health costs, for example. That's one of the costs that companies have to look at. Health cost goes up because of the older people in the labor force. So there are both pluses and minuses.
What about training and keeping skills current? Is that a cost?
That is a cost, and what we have seen from various studies that because of the older people in the labor force, productivity has gone down slightly. So that is a problem for many corporations. So what I have seen in case of many companies, they have retraining programs to train people to get the skill that is required for the job that they're doing. So there are some training programs that companies have.
Why do we see waning productivity or a slight drop in productivity?
That is something that we have seen in the U.S. economy for some time right now. Productivity has gone down slightly. It's possible that older workers are not as productive as, let's say, younger workers. That may be one reason we have seen that happen.
We're talking about retirement and why many Americans are delaying it past 65, what this means for how our workplaces get along across generations. Abdur Chaudhry is an emeritus professor of economics at Marquette, and he stays with us. Are you an older worker who is unemployed? Have you struggled to find a job because of your age? Why did you leave your prior position? Do you find yourself working because you want to? How has staying at work changed your life in your 60s or in your 70s? Join in this conversation any point here, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what happens as more Americans postpone retirement. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And over the past few decades, employers have shifted the financial risks of retirement onto workers. More than half of workers now have no workplace pension of any kind. And then a survey out from the Associated Press says almost a quarter of Americans say they plan to never retire because they don't have enough money to live on in an old age. So how does this impact our workplace? Do you see this where you work? Will you ever retire? We're at 800-642-1234. Abdur Chaudhry is an emeritus professor of economics at Marquette, and he stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Val is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Val.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chaudhry. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what is your vantage point, Val?
My question is, I was wondering, aside from not setting aside enough money to retire on in their, you know, in the older years, what your guest's thought is on cutting overhead expenses and suggesting that a lot of people who are on limited incomes who have not set aside money for retirement, getting roommates to cut those overhead expenses. If that is something that is, you know, I think it's a viable option, and I'm just wondering how many people he meets or talks to end up going that route.
Yeah, Val, can I ask a little more personal? What does your retirement outlook look like?
I had a 401k, and I had around 25 grand in it, and then the stock market tanked, and I lost it all.
So what does that mean for you today?
I basically I have a small savings, but like most Americans, I live PTP,
paycheck to paycheck. Yeah. Val, thank you so much for bringing that. Abdur, what can people do to cut down on their living expenses? Are there some creative solutions that you can put to use in those older years?
Thank you, Val, for your life story. This is a real problem that many retirees are facing, or would-be retirees are facing. They haven't saved enough, during their working age, they were spending money on conspicuous consumption. So obviously, you do have to look at your expenses, cut down unnecessary expenses, and basically you have to make your budget and follow that budget on a regular basis. So you have to be very, very careful about how you spend money, where you spend money, and you should try to save as much as possible for the retirement years.
Abdur, you're an emeritus professor. When did you decide to retire, and how did that decision come to be?
In my case, I retired in 2018, about a year ago. And to be honest with you, the main reason I retired was I wasn't enjoying my job as I used to. And I could see that myself. So then that's when I realized that maybe it's time that I try to do something else. So currently, I'm not working full time. I work part time for an investment firm, and I'm enjoying my time right now. So,
yeah, it sounds like you needed to switch. You needed a switch, and that really was the decision that helped you know it was time to retire from what you were currently doing.
Yes. As I said, I realized that I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. And also, to be fair, my university came out with some retirement incentives last year. So I thought, this may be the good time to retire.
Let's bring in Sam now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Sam.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think a big issue is the lack of pensions. And the idea that we have to follow our dreams. I'm giving up running my own business to take a union apprenticeship, mainly because of the pension. So I have a chance to retire.
Because this pension is drawing you to not work for yourself, but work for a major company?
Yeah, to really get involved with the union.
Union.
They offer an apprenticeship or offer a pension that's really great. And it's sad that isn't, an option for a lot of people anymore.
Sam, so it's really kind of guiding where you go next in terms of what that offering is. And a pension is really, attracting you to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to be able to retire eventually. I'm 26 and I need to start,
Yeah, Abdur,
getting that figured out now.
Yeah, Abdur, what does Sam need to be thinking about at age 26?
Yeah, he has long years ahead of him. So I think he has moved to a new job where, he has a pension plan. He may want to save a little bit extra every month in addition to what he contributes to the pension plan. And that will provide him with a big nest when he retires a couple of decades from now.
Let's bring in Joel in Middleton. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the contributing factors that are leading for people to stay in the workforce a little longer is that their children are staying home longer. They're not moving out at 18, 21. They're staying home till their mid-20s, early 30s now. And for every year that they stay home, it's an added expense for the parents to continue on supporting them. And another thing is health. A lot of people in America are obese, and they have a lot of health issues long before they retire. And they end up staying in the workforce just to maintain health benefits to help compensate for further medical expenses as well, because Medicaid can only cover so much, and the quality of the care that they receive is not adequate. So those are huge contributing factors.
Well, Joel, thank you for bringing those factors to the table. Abdur, starting with adult children living at home, what economic impact do you see there?
That's a good point that he has raised. We do see younger generation staying longer at home, as he pointed out. So obviously that puts some added pressure on their parents. So that's also one factor that has forces them to work longer hours, longer years. And also, as I mentioned that earlier, that increased health cost is also another contributing factor. And that we have seen in many places, where what we have seen is many companies are cutting down on their pension plans. They're reducing the health benefits that provide the retirees. So as a result, many workers are deciding to work longer years rather than retire.
Let's bring in John in Preston, Minnesota, with thoughts on this. John, good morning.
Yeah, hi. With a lot of these conversations I'm hearing, I feel like we're kind of missing the point here. And really, the fact is that American workers are more productive than they have been in decades. And for the most part, wages are stagnant. I mean, wages aren't stagnant for the 1%, or actually for the poor people. Their wages have been increasing for things like the fight through 15, but it's not because of some ambivalence through corporations or the capitalist system. And so we sit here talking about, oh, how can we be more efficient or save more money, or how can workers do more? Or, you know, that's not really what the problem is. The problem is we don't get paid enough.
John, we have to stop right there. But John brings up income inequity is at the root of this, Abdur.
Income inequality is a big problem in the U.S. As I mentioned earlier, we have seen income inequality increase, and it has increased more across racial lines. So income inequality increase has been a big problem for especially people with lower income. They have seen, as he pointed out, real wages have not increased. If you look at the last 10 years, real wages has been relatively flat, and that has affected low-income workers.
Well, as we wrap up here, 65 is the traditional retirement age. Should we consider a new retirement age for America?
I would say yes. Now, life expectancy has gone up significantly. People live longer. And so I would say a retirement age can be increased from 65 to, let's say, high 60s or low 70s.
Abdur, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Abdur Chaudhry is an emeritus professor of economics at Marquette. Just ahead, researchers at UW-Madison have uncovered a new reason why the brain requires sleep. We'll get into that. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.